Yeah, so thanks for having me and thanks for the nice introduction. I've been told that when they are asked to give a colloquium talk, then astrophysicists, like, no, wait, it's the other way around. Like, no matter what they are asked to give, astrophysicists always give a colloquium talk, and condensed matter physicists always give a seminar talk. So I'm trying my best here to give a colloquium talk and make a very general introduction. And if you have questions, you should interrupt me in between. Okay, so I put as a title how to solve quantum many-body problems, but I'm going to immediately tone it down a bit and be state instead how to try to solve quantum many-body problems. And so let me start my talk by showing you some video that I took on a family vacation. So this is on Plum Island, a bit like an hour to the north of Boston, and it's kind of famous for its like migrating birds that you can see here. And if you look at the birds in this like flock of birds, they basically follow a pretty simple set of rules. So basically, there is no like chief bird or whatever, but they all are the same and they all follow the simple set of rules, which means that they just look at some of their nearest neighbors, try to avoid crowding them, align with them, and steer towards the average positions of your neighbors. And by following those rules, you can see that they basically have this emerging behavior that you saw in this short video, where they basically as a whole, as this whole flock, move, and you see these nice patterns emerge. So this is very nice. If we now go to quantum many-body problems, it's pretty much the same. So we also have a simple set of rules. And today, everything I want to talk about is based on this Fermi-Hubbard model. So this is the model that we're going to look at. And so it's instead of birds, we now have fermions. So this is what I'm indicating with this little blue and red balls here. And they are blue and red because they have they can either be spin up or spin down. And the rules that these particles are following now is that they want to hop around as much as possible. So they have this hopping amplitude T. They can never sit on the same side as a fermion with equal spin. So in this picture, this means blue cannot sit on top of blue and red cannot sit on top of red. And they try to avoid sitting on top of fermions with the opposite spin. So even though red and blue can sit on the same side, they try to avoid doing this. And we basically put down these rules in the form of a Hamiltonian that looks like this. So here we have this hopping term, so we're trying to hop around as much as possible. And here we have this energy penalty term, which basically tells you that they should avoid sitting on top of each other. So far, so good. It looks simple enough, but it turns out to be extremely challenging to figure out what these electrons are going to do now. So the question you might ask now is, why should I care what these electrons or fermions are doing even? And one big motivation to look at the Fermi-Hubbard model, so this model in particular, comes from high temperature superconductivity. So basically, when superconductivity was discovered originally, people put a limit more or less on here, so around 30 Kelvin, as the maximum critical temperature. So they said, if you have superconductivity in a material, the critical temperature to reach superconductivity cannot be above roughly 30 Kelvin. But then in 1986, the cuprate materials were discovered, and they exhibit this superconductivity at unexpectedly high temperatures. So you can basically see how this curve, so this is over the years, the materials in which we found superconductivity, and you can see basically this shooting, shooting up here. And so this is, of course, very exciting, because if you have high temperature superconductivity, so basically means superconductivity with high critical temperatures, there's a lot of amazing things that you prospectively could do with that, like build like more efficient cables, like the superconducting cable that they're actually building in Munich here. You can use this in like these wind turbines and so on. So, I mean, I'm not an engineer, but if you have a material that is superconducting at very high temperatures, there is a lot of obvious applications for those. But now the problem, and that's why you should care about the Fermi-Hubbard model, is that we don't really know why these materials are superconducting at such high temperatures. So we don't really understand the mechanism behind the superconductivity. And that also means that we are not really in a position to design materials with these properties so that are superconducting to maybe reach higher critical temperatures or to engineer materials with even better material properties that you can use better to build, say, a superconducting cable, for example. And that's why we are going back to these kind of very simple quantum many-body models, like the Fermi-Hubbard model, to try to understand them. And of course, there's more than just the Fermi-Hubbard model to quantum many-body problems. So there is a lot of other applications that I don't even want to go into, like quantum computing, quantum chemistry also, and of course also fundamental research questions and also other materials research apart from superconductivity. So the question then is, what can we do with our quantum many-body problem now? And so the first thing on my list here is experiments on real materials. And that's basically how, for example, this high-temperature superconductivity was discovered. So people looked at real materials and they ran experiments on them. And I don't want to talk about this because that's very messy. So you have all sorts of other ingredients. It's very hard to understand. The data that you get out of there is very noisy. And so it's definitely what I ultimately want to loop back to. But it's also, I would say, maybe the hardest way to gain insights here. Now, the next thing that you can do is you can do analytical approximations. And there's, of course, a lot to be done in that direction to figure out what approximations you can and cannot make, compare that to experiments or numerical simulations. Then numerical simulations, you can only do in an exact fashion for very small systems. So for example, for the Fermi-Hubbard model, if you want to run an exact simulation, you basically can only do a 4x4 system. So that's basically what I have been drawing on the other slide, when you have like this square lattice and you have just 16 sites in total. So you just have a 4x4 system, so that's very small. Other numerical methods basically mean that you are going to throw away some information. And the question you then have to solve is, which degrees of freedom are you going to throw away? And the last part that I have here is quantum simulation. And I'm going to talk about that a bit more now. And as a theorist, one of the main questions, if we are talking about quantum simulation, is what should we be looking for if we do quantum simulation? And so quantum simulation basically means you take a system that you can control very well to now simulate the Hamiltonian, so the easy rules that your system should follow in an actual quantum system. And there is different platforms to do that, just showing some examples. So for example, this is the IBM superconducting qubit setup. These are trapped ions. Then there is Rydberg atoms and optical tweezers. And this is cold atoms in optical lattices. And I mainly today want to talk about the cold atoms and optical lattices, because that's kind of the prime realization of the Fermi-Hubbard model that I'm interested in. The main idea here is that you have, if you have your solid, then you would describe how your electrons move through this periodic potential in this solid material. And exactly the same thing we can now emulate by using interfering laser beams. So that's basically what's sketched here. So you would have like your laser beam that interferes, and it creates an optical potential that looks like this. And now, instead of electrons that move through a solid, what we have is neutral atoms that move through this periodic potential that has been created by these interfering laser beams. And so this has a lot of advantages. One of them is that you can control it now very well. So as opposed to solids, we threw away a lot of the things that make it messy. So we, for example, we don't have any phonons in these systems. The disorder is well controlled. And we know pretty well which Hamiltonian we are realizing. And moreover, we can control the parameters of this Hamiltonian. So we can do a much more controlled study. Still experiments, we can go to larger systems, and we can control it very well. And the other advantage is, what we did here is basically to scale up. So instead of looking at tiny electrons, we are now looking at atoms. And because we scaled up so much, we can actually do something that's called quantum gas microscopy, which means that we can take a real space picture of those atoms. So we can have like an optical setup, a microscope, and take an image like this. And those little dots that you're seeing is actually the atoms in there. So that's pretty cool, I would say. And so you get a lot of microscopic information about your system with these snapshots. And it's going beyond just taking a picture of atoms, because you really are doing quantum projective measurements. So what this means is that if you have a quantum state, and I'm writing it up here, that can be a superposition of many different configurations. So say you have this spin system, you have these spin ups and downs, and your actual quantum state of your system is a superposition of many of those different configurations. And now if you run your experiment once, you will measure this configuration. And then if you run it again, you might measure this configuration and so on. So you really do kind of textbook quantum projective measurements where if you repeat the exact same experiment, you will get out most of the time a different snapshot given by the probability with which it appears in this superposition of the quantum state. So what this means is that you not only have this single side resolution that you see here again, so where you can like really, for each side, you can determine whether there is an atom sitting there or not. But on top of that, you really get this host of information about the quantum many-body state that you're looking at because you're really doing these quantum projective measurements and obtaining a whole set of images that look something like this here. Okay, so far so good. Okay. So what I want to, so this is kind of the outline for the talk. So I first want to give a very, very, very rough introduction to the Fermi-Hubbard model so that you get some idea what we are talking about. And then I want to talk a bit first about a single hole and then going to many holes. And many holes, I should also say here, that's when we talk about quantum many-body physics, we typically start saying many when we mean three or more than that. But I want to really go to maybe 10 or so. And finally, I'm going to talk a bit about what we can do with machine learning to analyze those quantum snapshots. Okay, so starting with the Fermi-Hubbard model again, it looks fairly simple. So we have this square lattice that I was showing, and we basically only have these two terms. So we have a tunneling T, and we have this interaction term U. And now if we start at high temperatures and low fillings, we just get this metal state where you have these fermions that hop around in your system, and we're at low filling, so they hardly see each other. And the opposite limit, where you put a lot of particles into your system, you get what's called a band insulator. And that basically means that now if you have like an up and a down fermion sitting on each lattice side, and that means nothing can happen anymore. And that's why it's an insulator, because there is no movement whatsoever. They are just stuck where they are. And we can go in a different direction also. So you can start at half filling at high temperatures. So half filling means you have on average one fermion per lattice side now. But they don't necessarily have to sit one fermion per lattice side. It's just the average number. So if you're at high temperatures, you will still get the metal. But now if you lower the temperatures, as soon as the temperature gets significantly lower than your interaction strength, your system will basically want to avoid those double occupancies. And you will just have one atom sitting or one fermion sitting on each lattice side here. And that's what's called a Mott insulator. So here, this is an insulator, not because nothing can move, because in principle, something could move and create a double occupancy, but that's energetically unfavored. So you don't want to do that, because if you get these double occupancies, you basically have to pay this interaction energy U. And at low temperatures, you don't want to do that. Okay. So what we can do now is to make an approximation in the limit where this interaction strength is very large. And this is the limit that we care about. So typically, for what we care about, the interaction strength will be something like 10 times this tunneling strength T. So this term here will be very large. And that basically means that it almost never happens that two fermions sit on top of each other. And then we can basically make the approximation and say, OK, if this only happens virtually, so if this very rarely happens, instead of looking at this Fermi-Hubbard model, we can also look at this TJ model. And now this might, to you, not look so much easier, but in some respects it is. And what it basically does, it projects out double occupancies. So you still have this tunneling term, but this projector here tells you that you can never have a double occupancy in your system. And what this means is that for each side now, instead of having four possibilities, you only have three. So before, you could have a hole, a spin up, a spin down, or what's called a doublon, which would be a spin up and a spin down. And now we got rid of that last possibility, and we can only have a hole, a spin up, or a spin down. And from a numerical perspective, this is a huge help, because you just killed, like, if your Hilbert space dimension grows with your 4 to the system size or 3 to the system size, that makes a large difference in how things scale. But also, and this is the main reason actually why I'm showing this, if you directly look at this Hamiltonian that you get out here, you can also understand things a bit better. Because what you get here, after you made this approximation, is this spin exchange term. So this is this S dot S term. And what this spin exchange term basically wants is that it wants to have spin up sitting next to spin down. So now we basically have an interplay of two different things. So we have this spin exchange term that goes with J, and this wants the system to order antiferromagnetically. And we have this tunneling term that we also had before that basically wants those fermions to hop around through the system. And maybe just as a side note, but it turns out that this transformation going from the Fermi-Hubbard model to the TJ model, you can actually even do experimentally. So I just, this is a bit of a technical thing, but basically you see here how often you detect a doublon, and it turns out that in the experiment, depending on how you ramp your optical lattices, you can go from the Fermi-Hubbard limit, which is up here, to the TJ limit, which would be somewhere down here where you hardly get any doublon occupancies. So this TJ approximation is something that's not unreasonable to also directly see in these quantum simulation experiments. But okay, so back to the Hamiltonian. So if we are now again at half filling, so that means we have exactly one fermion sitting on each lattice side, then at high temperatures, we start again with the metal, that's what we saw before. Then as we lower the temperature, we get this charge order. So this is this mod insulator that I've shown before. And now, if we lower the temperature even further, we will also get spin order. So this spin order basically means that we get this antiferromagnetic ordering. And in a very cartoon picture, you should expect that if you have a spin, say, up sitting here, then you will have like a spin down here, or a spin up again, and so on. So that's a cartoon picture of this model. And these antiferromagnetic correlations have also been seen in cold atom experiments. So this is a correlation map where you're looking at the spin correlations now relative to this side, and you see that you get this nice checkerboard pattern of your spin correlations here. Okay, so now this is what condensed matter people always want to look at, is phase diagrams. So we have two axes now that we want to look at, or that we can look at here. And one is the temperature axis, and the other is the doping axis here. And this antiferromagnetic ordering happens basically here if you don't have doping. And doping, what doping now means is that you punch holes into your antiferromagnet. So if you go away from this axis here, you will basically get an interplay between the system wanting to order antiferromagnetically, but also you have holes in your system that basically want to move around as much as possible. And we want to know what happens then, because we have to go along this doping direction to get all the interesting stuff. So for example, to see superconductivity, but also the other phases in this Fermi-Hubbard phase diagram that we care about. To see them, we basically have to go away from this easy to understand half filling limit. Okay, so let's start in small steps with a single hole. And for a single hole, the way you can understand this, or the way that we like to describe it, is in terms of what we call the geometric string theory. So you start from your antiferromagnetically ordered system, and you punch a hole into the system. And now the two terms that you have in your Hamiltonian is that the Hamiltonian wants to keep this antiferromagnetic ordering intact as much as possible, but also this hole wants to lower its kinetic energy, so it wants to move around as much as possible. And as the hole moves through the system, and that's the whole issue, it basically messes up this antiferromagnetic ordering. So you basically get a competition between how much the hole can move around and lower its kinetic energy, and how much you mess up your antiferromagnetic background. And now you can basically define what we call a string tension, because for each hop, so for each of these line segments that you see here, you have to pay the energy that it basically cost to mess up this bond. So you basically, these two spins used to be nearest neighbors, but now they are next nearest neighbors. So basically this difference in the spin-spin correlation function is the energy cost that you will have, the hole will have to pay for making this movement. Okay, so this is a very rough sketch. You can also view this in a type of Born-Oppenheimer approximation, where you basically say you have a product ansatz between your spin excitation and your charge excitation. And the point is now that the spin excitation is much slower than the charge excitation, because the spin excitation can only move with this coupling constant J that we saw in our Hamiltonian. And this J is typically much smaller than T. And this T basically gives you the motion of this charge excitation, but they are bound together through the string. And the string is basically what you saw in the slide before. So actually, let me show this once more. So this is what we would call the string. It's basically the string of displaced spins. So this trace that the hole leaves behind. And because this string costs you energy, that means it cannot get arbitrarily long because there is a cost to it. And therefore, the spin excitation, so basically the spin excitation that you created here, is bound to this charge excitation by the string. So the two of them can only move as a compound object through the system now. And so it is it's all very rough, so like very hand-wavy terms so far. But I think the most intuitive way maybe to see it is in terms of a real space experiment. So what we can do numerically, and this is using matrix product states, so that's a numerical method that's best working for one-dimensional systems. So what we are doing here is basically defining a one-dimensional system by putting a snake through this 2D system. But it also means that we can only make something like four legs in the one direction. So you see, I say it's like a 2D system, but it has only like four legs in one of the two directions. And what we're going to do now is to punch a hole into the system and look in real time what this hole is going to do. And what you're looking at here is now the distance that the hole has traveled relative to the origin where we created it as a function of time. And this red line here, this matrix product state simulation, is a simulation of the actual microscopic Hamiltonian. And this we can now compare to this approximative semi-analytic geometric string theory. So this geometric string theory basically is something that you can write down and more or less solve for arbitrary large systems. And you can see that it agrees very nicely. So this distance here, this like shaded red line, agrees extremely nicely with the numerical simulation of the actual microscopic Hamiltonian. And the other thing that you can see here is that you basically get two timescales. So you create your excitation, which is a spin and a charge excitation at the same time. And then at short times, you form your string object. So this is what's happening here. And that means that your whole distance to the origin is growing very quickly. So you have this fast velocity in the beginning. And that's when the charge excitation moves away from the spin excitation quickly. And then at longer times, the two of them are bound together and can only move slowly through the system. And therefore, you get a second velocity, which is determined just by the spinal dynamics, which is slower. So this is this second regime here. And now we can go and put our theory, this whole string picture, to another test. Because as I told you before, we can take these quantum projective measurements. So we can do that in a quantum simulator experiment. But of course, we can also do that numerically as far as our system sizes go. And the idea here is that if our state is some superposition of different string configurations, so the string might go down, it might go like right and up, and so on. So if our string is a superposition of all these different configurations, and we just look at the average of it, we will get just this fuzzy cloud here. But in principle, we can also sample these quantum projective measurements of our state. And then we will, in one of these snapshots, that's what we call it, measure this configuration. In another one, measure this configuration, and so on. And now we can go, and for each of these quantum snapshots that we're sampling, we can look for the string patterns. So a snapshot might look something like this. And the way we're going to look for string patterns is by subtracting the perfect nil state, so this perfect checkerboard pattern here from the actual snapshot. And when we now go and subtract this perfect nil state from the pattern, we basically get the difference. And now we're going to say, OK, this disturbance of our checkerboard that's attached to the hole, that is our string pattern. So this is what we define as the string pattern. So in this case, we would have found a string pattern of length 2. And now we can go back to this dynamics plot that we saw before. And in each of these time steps, look for how long the string pattern is on average. And if we go and do that, what we find is basically that in the beginning, initially, the length of these string patterns grows very rapidly, and then later it settles off. And so what this means is that our picture is, to this extent as we can, confirmed here, because initially our string pattern length is growing rapidly, which means that we are forming this string But then at longer times, the distance that the hole travels from the origin is still growing, but the string pattern's length is staying more or less constant, which basically means that now the string as a whole is moving throughout the system. And this is, again, numerical simulations that match sort of to this geometric string theory approach that we have here. Okay, so this was one hole, and there's, of course, a lot of checks that you can run for this single hole here. But the question is, what happens if you now put many of those holes into the system? And that makes things a lot harder in every respect, I would say. So there was last year a numerics review. So these are people who basically do nothing else but try to like tackle the Fermi-Hawat model with numerical methods. And I mean, this Fermi-Hawat model has been around for like 60 years or so. And what they say in their review about the numerical methods for the Fermi-Hawat model is not much is known. So I found it pretty funny. So it tells you a bit how challenging this is actually to do anything for it. But one way out, as I was mentioning, is, of course, quantum simulation experiments. And one question that you can ask now is, if you have a quantum simulation realization of the Fermi-Hawat model, what should you be looking for? And one option is to emulate solid-state experiments. And this is something that people have been looking into. For example, here they're looking at transport properties, which is, of course, a very common thing to look for in solid-state experiments. Here they are doing angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy, so ARPAS, on the Fermi-Hawat model in a cold atom experiment. So this is one approach where you basically say, OK, I'm trying to figure out whether this model is really describing the materials that I'm interested in by running more or less the same experiments on this model that you could run on the material and comparing the outcome. The other option is to make use of this microscopic real space information that we have in those snapshots. And so here I'm just going to show you one example where we did that, namely where we basically now look as a function of doping. We are looking for how many of these string counts we are finding in our system. And so the idea is now that basically we are treating, so we have now many holes in our system. So for example, if you have a 10 by 10 system, 10% doping means that you have 10 holes in your system. And we are asking, okay, does the number of string patterns that we find increase as we put more holes into the system? Which it should, right? Because if I'm saying each of these holes is creating a string pattern, then as I increase the number of holes in my system, I should also increase the number of string counts that I found. And this is exactly what we're seeing here. So this is basically now just looking at the string patterns that I was describing earlier for the numerics, but now in experimental snapshots, so an experimental realization of the Fermi-Hawat model where the doping is tuned. And what you see is that at low doping, the number of the string patterns that you find actually increases linearly, which is very nice. But then as you go to higher and higher dopings, what you see is that it starts to bend over. So here, it's very hard to claim that this is still linearly growing with the doping anymore. And the reason for that is that this picture that the number of string patterns increases linearly as you put more holes in the system is only true as long as these holes are kind of dilute. So if you put in these objects and these, you know, you have this spin on, charge on, bound together by the string, and they are more or less independently moving through the system. In that regime, you are fine. But as soon as you put so many in there that the strings start to overlap and these objects see each other, our picture is wrong from two sides. One is because we don't take any interaction into account, so we treat these as independent objects. So that's a problem. And the other problem is that this algorithm to detect the string patterns cannot really deal with the fact when these strings are crossing and so on. So in this regime, we really don't expect this string pattern observable to be really so great. But you see already, this is something that goes way beyond just doing a transport measurement, because you're really looking into the microscopic structure of your charge carriers here. So you're really looking at what is each individual charge carrier doing, how is each of these holes going to mess up your spin background. And of course, there's not just us with our geometric string theory. There's a lot of there's a lot of theories that people put forward to describe the dope Fermi-Hawat model and to gain some understanding. And one of them was put forward by Phil Anderson And he basically has this picture where he says you have a resonating valence bond state. So the idea here is basically that you have these singlets. So each spin is very strongly correlated with one other spin. And which other spin that is, that changes. So you have the superposition of different of these configurations. And the main picture is that you have this soup of singlets through which your holes can then move. And so this, I mean, this might seem very hand-wavy to you, but the main point is that these two theories are very different on a microscopic level, because here the holes are moving freely through the soup of singlets, and you don't really care about any correlations between the hole and the spin background, whereas here in the geometric string theory, all we are doing is to take into account the correlations between the charge and the spin. So conceptually, these are pretty different theories. And now you might ask, okay, so which theory does describe now what's happening in the actual Fermi-Hubbard model? And in a different context, but Steve Kibbison put it as a way in regards to solving the Fermi-Hubbard model, that the theoretical problem is so hard that there isn't an obvious criterion for right. And maybe you can see it if you look at these images here. So these are now snapshots that you can look at from both of these theories, so this geometric string theory and this resonating valence bond state, as well as the experimental realization, so the ground truth of the Fermi-Hubbard model. And you can see that they all look extremely similar. So it's very hard to say, okay, this snapshot looks distinctly different from that, but somewhat similar to that. And so one approach now is to take all those snapshots and use machine learning to analyze them. And one thing that we did here was to use a neural network and to train it to distinguish snapshots from the two theories. So we used a neural network and we put in snapshots from geometric string theory and from this resonating valence bond theory. And so basically the same way that people would be labeling images after whether there is a cat or a dog appearing, the neural network would now, for each snapshot that you put in, it would assign the label whether this is a resonating valence bond state or a geometric string theory state. And then you get an output from this, which tells you how well you have learned this. And then after training, we would leave the network parameters fixed and put in experimental snapshots. But now, as you can see in this little sketch of the robot here, it doesn't have a label for experiment. It only has the label for geometric string theory or for this pi-flux or resonating valence bond theory. So it cannot say, OK, this picture is from the experiment. It can only say it resembles either of the two theories more closely. So what we basically get as an output then is for each experimental snapshot, we get a label for either of the two theories. And now we can repeat the whole procedure for all of our doping levels. And what we find is that as a function of doping, the fraction of experimental snapshots which gets detected as either theory starts off high in the geometric string theory regime and then goes down, and then somewhere around this 15 to 20% doping, they are hardly distinguishable anymore. Okay, so I was pretty happy with this, but then the question that I kept getting at this point was, what is the network really looking for? And what we realized is that what makes it very hard to interpret a neural network like this is that you have typically some nonlinear activation function in your neural network. And you want to have this nonlinear activation function because otherwise you're just going to do linear algebra. So you definitely want to have some nonlinear activation function for the neural network to be able to learn something. But on the other hand, if you have these standard nonlinear activation functions that are established in the machine learning community, what happens is that it makes it extremely difficult to learn anything from the network. So people would be like, oh, you're using this convolutional neural network. Why don't you just look at the filters? But if you just look at the filters in this kind of problem where you have these kind of quantum many-body systems on a lattice, it's basically impossible to understand anything. So what we came up with is a modification of this nonlinear activation function. So we start with the same step. So we have an input, which consists of three channels. So it can be spin up, spin down, or hold. And then we learn these filters here. So the weights in these filters is what's learned in the training process. We do the convolution. So far, it's exactly the same as you would do in a standard convolutional neural network. But then instead of applying the standard nonlinear activation function, we basically do this expansion in higher orders here. And this is for many body physicists, this is all we care about, is basically higher order correlation functions. So first order, second order, but then you can go to arbitrary high orders. And in principle, if you know all your higher order correlation functions in your quantum many-body system, you would know all about this system. Of course, here we only have equal time correlations. We only measure in one basis, so we don't really know all there is. But higher order correlation functions is really what we care about. And so basically what we do here as a nonlinear activation function is that we do this expansion in higher order correlation functions that we can extract here. Then we average spatially, so we get an estimate for each correlator. And then we basically do just a logistic regression part in the end here. And this comes with a couple of nice things that you can tune now. So one is, as a hyperparameter, you can now tune to which order in your correlation functions you're going. So here we are doing this for the exact same task that I was describing, namely distinguishing the two theories. And you see, okay, if we just go to order one, we basically don't learn anything. So our accuracy, so this is the accuracy during training, and it stays more or less at 50%. So 50% for a binary classification task is nothing is happening. Then if we go to second order, we get some improvement. We go to third order still, but then all of these lines are fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh order, and they basically all give the same result. So this tells you that basically if you go to up to fourth order in your higher order correlation function, there's still something to be learned. There's still more information inside your snapshots. If you now go to higher and higher orders, there's not much more to be gained for this particular task that you have at hand. And the other thing that we do is when we basically, let me go back to this slide. So basically after we have trained the weights in these filters and we've done kind of this training here, we fix all of that and we basically retrain this back portion where we have these weights beta here. And now we can, in our cost function of training the neural network, we can put a penalty on these weights beta. And if we make this penalty, so this lambda, very, very large, that means that the network rather classifies everything wrong than putting any weight beta into the system. And then as we slowly turn down this lambda, it makes sense for the network to turn on the most important beta first and so on. So you see here the accuracy as a function of 1 over lambda. So basically as we go in this direction, we are allowing for more and more of these beta values to be turned on. And you see that there is a big jump in the accuracy as soon as this beta here, this beta, and this is the fourth order coefficient is turned on. And then there's another jump as the other filter is turned on. So that basically means there is two separate filters that play a role. And the most important correlation functions is the fourth order correlation functions. So that gives you the biggest jump in your accuracy. And then, of course, you get a bit more improvement if you allow other correlation functions in there. But the largest contribution really comes from the fourth order correlation functions contained in those two filters. Okay, so now what are those correlation functions? And if we look at them more closely, what we see is that for a snapshot to be classified as a geometric string theory snapshot, what we find is that we basically want to have patterns like these. So what this really means is that we have a hole sitting here, and there should be two aligned spins next to it. So remember, if we had this perfect AFM background, we would always want to have down next to up. But now we're looking for a hole that has two aligned instead of anti-aligned spins sitting next to it. And this is, of course, exactly what we get in this geometric string theory picture too, because if this hole moves through the AFM, it distorts the AFM background, and it creates these kind of aligned instead of anti-aligned spins here right next to it. So this makes a lot of sense. And now, okay, so these are much harder to interpret. And it's also because this resonating valence bond state by construction doesn't have a lot of information if we just measure in this basis that we're measuring in. So this is hard to learn anything from, but that's sort of by construction from this state. But what we can do now is we can go and directly look for these correlation functions in an actual realization of the Fermi-Hubbard model. So here, the doping is now tuned through a large range. And what you're looking at is basically, given that the hole is here, what do the spin correlation functions surrounding this hole look like? And what you see, so red here means that they are aligned, lumens that they are anti-aligned. And what you see is that these nearest neighbor spin correlation functions here, they are now aligned instead of anti-aligned at small doping. But then as you increase the doping, so somewhere between this 18 and this 28% doping measurement point, you see that the sign actually flips. So we can also look at this as a line plot. So basically, we're looking now at the nearest neighbor spin correlation functions relative to the whole as a function of doping. And the symbols are the experimental data. And what you see is that exactly somewhere around 20% doping, you see that this correlation function actually crosses zero. So here, it's positive, and that actually increases nicely with the string theory prediction. So that's this blue line. But then as you go to higher and higher doping, this correlation function actually becomes negative again. So what I've shown you so far is that you, within this phase diagram, so we've been moving along these lines here. So basically, I've shown you experimental data from this line and from this line here. And we saw in sort of different measurements, we saw that this geometric string theory picture seems to be good at low dopings. So up to 10, 15%, you get this linear increase in the string pattern count. The machine learning tells you that the geometric string theory is the better description. We can then, with the interpretable tool, figure out which correlation function is most important. And we see the sign change then happening somewhere in between here. And to maybe very hand-wavily put this into perspective with experiments on cuprate materials. So what people have seen here is that in this regime of like around 15% doping, basically the nature of the charge carriers also changes. So I don't really want to go into much detail here, but they are looking at a function of doping at the number of charge carriers. They do that through some transport measurements. And what they find is that here, up to something like 10, 15% doping, this number of charge carriers scales with the doping. And then there is this jump here, and something drastically happens that changes. So you can see that we are coming from a very different perspective. I don't want to put this into one-to-one correspondence. But you can see that we are in the process of gaining some insights as to why the nature of the charge carriers might be changing, or how we can observe this in a microscopic perspective on the Fermi-Hubbard model. Okay, so far I've been moving along this direction and looking at experimental snapshots. Let me look also again a little bit at the other direction here. So when the superconductivity was originally found in these cuprate materials, so this is somewhere like the superconducting dome down here, one of the first questions that people had is what's happening as you increase the temperature. So basically the question is, what sort of normal state does the superconducting state emerge from? And so they did basically experiments as they scanned the temperature and looking and found something, what people call the pseudogap phase. This is this abbreviation PG here. And this is one of the first experiments that they did. So as a function of the temperature now, you're looking at some value, some finite doping value at the spin susceptibility. And so the spin susceptibility shows this peak here. So basically, there is this suppression here of the spin susceptibility at these low temperatures. And this, so basically, this position, this temperature position of this peak is what people then defined as the pseudogap temperature. And they were wondering, because in principle, you could expect this to just keep growing up here. But instead, it bends down. There is a, so it's basically harder to put spin into the system. And one interpretation of why people were excited about this is that they said, OK, if you have superconductivity, you need pairs of charge carriers to form. And if these pairs of charge carriers are now singlet, so if always spin up and spin down form together, then you would have the suppression of spin excitations below the temperature at which these pairs form. So basically, the idea that people had in mind now was that you might have something like preformed pairs which give you this the suppression of your spin susceptibility, of your spin excitations below some temperature here. Whether this is true or not, I would say is still up for debate. This pseudogap phase in general is one of the hardest thing to understand about this whole phase diagram. People, there's a variety of different measurements done here. But I want to look at the simplest limit here, namely go back to this half-filling limit and check what's happening in those quantities if we just look at a pure spin system. And this is much easier now. We just have to look at spins. We don't have to worry about holes anymore. And we are asking what happens if you are in this two-dimensional Heisenberg model. So we just have this S dot S term now as we tune the temperature of our system. And people have done, of course, a lot of numerical studies also on this. So this is quantum Monte Carlo results. And they are like, I think, almost 30 years old also. And so what you're looking at here is this susceptibility as a function of temperature. So this is the same thing that you saw before. Now it's just a numerical simulation of the spin model. And you again see this peak here. And this peak occurs at the same temperature where you start to develop long-range correlations. So this is the correlation length. So basically, how long can you go that you still see correlations between a spin here and a spin there? And you see this correlation length really shoots up. And this happens more or less at the same temperature where you see this, this peak in the susceptibility. And what we did now is we looked, and I don't want to go into much details of how we did it, but we did an unsupervised machine learning scheme where we looked again at snapshots of the Heisenberg model. And the scheme that we are using, so that's this red data that you're looking at here, basically says that if there is a qualitative change happening in your data, then there will be a peak somewhere in between. If there was no qualitative change happening, this should just be like a V shape. So it just should just go down and up. But if there is a W shape, so if there's a peak happening in between, then there is a qualitative change happening in your data. And it's happening exactly where you where this peak is occurring. And what I'm also showing here is both the spin susceptibility, so it's the same data that you saw before, but also, and this is this light gray curve, the specific heat. So this is another measurement that you can do on solids. And what you see is that both of these quantities show a peak. They show it at slightly different temperatures. Both of these temperatures people have interpreted as a pseudogap temperature. And you see that if you just go and look at those snapshots without putting any knowledge into the system in an unsupervised machine learning setup, and you really just look at these snapshots that you could also get from an experiment, it tells you, OK, something is happening right here, which basically is somewhat to the right of this temperature, somewhat to the left of this temperature here. And of course, we did this not only unsupervised, but also in an interpretable way, because we can just use this interpretable network architecture that I showed you before. And so we can go and ask the network architecture what it is looking for. But now the issue is, if you remember, we are using a convolutional setup. And in this convolutional setup, we basically, in the beginning, we define a convolutional filter. And so this convolutional filter has a finite size. And this means that if you wanted to capture something like this rise in the correlation length, which would maybe be the most natural thing, you cannot do it because you're looking at a 2x2 filter only. So somehow, this network is detecting some qualitative change in the data, even though you are only looking at a very small scale thing. And what we realized, and this is really work done by Henning, that it's looking at the fluctuations of this C1. So basically, it's looking at how many fluctuations are there in your nearest neighbor spin correlation functions. And now you can go and write out what it basically means, what the fluctuations in your nearest neighbor spin correlation functions mean. And it turns out you get a four-point correlation function that looks like this. And in this four-point correlation function, one thing that you get is actually contributions from long-range correlation functions. So even though the network is trained to just learn small 2x2 filters, by basically considering the something that we like to call the full counting statistics of this short distance correlation functions, it's able to really learn something about the long range correlation function. So this is IZ, is JZ here, which captures this, this growth of the correlation length here. So that's basically what's contained in this spin susceptibility. But then it turns out that also if you now take the connected part of this 4-point spin correlation function, so basically that means that you subtract all the lower order correlation functions. So that means you also subtract this thing here, then you still are stuck with something that shows a qualitative change happening. And we think this is because you can still see some remnants of this specific heat, so of this other quantity that I was showing, in this four-point correlation function. So what this basically means is that we found something here in a limit where people thought the model was pretty well understood. So in this 2D Heisenberg model, where you can still go and look for new observables, like this four-point spin correlation function, and you can gain some insights from these quantum projective measurements that can be obtained in a quantum simulation experiment. And now, of course, because we are basing this on numerical snapshots, we just looked at this axis. But now, as a next step, we can go and also look at the doping range and just either perform the same machine learning analysis or directly go and look for this four-point spin correlation function as we tune the doping and try to understand whether what's happening as we tune the temperature is similar or not as to what happens as we tune the doping range here. Okay, the reason we haven't done this yet is, as I was saying, that it's very hard numerically to gain any insights. So this is the same quotation from this numerics review. And one thing that they don't talk about in this review from last year is a new type of numerical simulations. And that's neural network quantum states. So I just want to give this as a very brief outlook here. So the idea is now that we can use a neural network to represent our quantum state of interest and basically use this as a variational ansatz to do a Monte Carlo simulation here. And this was put forward originally 6 years ago. And since then, I would say there's been a large surge in activity in this field. Also actually here at Perimeter, where the idea was put forward to also use somewhat more advanced network structures than this, and also to basically put the two-dimensionalness of the system really into place here. And this is something that we, and in particular Hanna, who is also visiting this week, has been doing, namely to use this 2D structure and these particular type of networks to now simulate fermionic systems. And I'm emphasizing this so much because typically people prefer to just look at spin systems because they are conceptually somewhat easier because you don't have to take into account the exchange statistics. So looking at fermions is really, I would say, a new challenge here. And we're seeing that it seems to be possible. So you're looking here at some training and how, in particular, the energy, so the error of your energy, reaches the more or less correct value if you train long enough. So we are quite optimistic that you can also use now these neural network quantum states to maybe gain some insights into these fermionic systems in the future. OK, so as a very brief summary, let me show you once again this phase diagram and mention the different approaches that we took. So we basically looked at the snapshots. We found signatures of something that might be related to the pseudo gap in those snapshots. From a numerical perspective, we are looking at these neural network quantum states. And from a semi-analytical perspective, I showed you how we can have a theory for a single hole. We're also looking into this for now two holes. And basically, this should hopefully give us also a better idea of what to look for again in the end in numerical and experimental data. So let me thank you for your attention.
I was just wondering, what is the current consensus that the Hubble model you're using is capturing all the physics that is necessary to describe these new high-temperature superconductors?
That's an excellent question. So I would say the numerical consensus is that it does not. So basically, there's been a large-scale numerical study that the plain vanilla Fermi-Hubbard model that I was showing does not capture superconductivity. So people, let's see if I have it. So there's basically what I show here is charge density wave, or people also call it stripe order. And people have done like large-scale numerical simulations where they found that basically, if you look at the ground state of the Hubbard model in the parameter regime of, I think, U over T equals 8 or so, you basically never actually get superconductivity because this gray dome here is extending all through the way. So you always get this charge density wave order instead of superconductivity. So what we think now, and what needs to be included is basically a T prime term, which means that you also have a diagonal hopping in your system. So that's basically kind of a thing that I would say a lot of us are looking into now, of how you can look at this from a quantum simulation experimental point of view, but also how you could include this in numerics. I would say it doesn't make things much easier. But so yes, some modifications of this model are underway. And I think it's actually a super interesting route to think about how you can really get the relevant terms in your Hamiltonian out of experiments on that were done on these materials. So basically, how can you figure out which terms in your Hamiltonian do you really need to describe the phenomenology?
Thanks. Just slight follow-up. So do you think this T prime term is sufficient, or is there something more exotic that can be done? That I don't know, deformation of the geometry or something that is not normally done, but might be something that is related to one of the newer experiments. So it's like, for example, are you tuning the parameters of your Hubbard model to capture the increase of, or when you design a new high temperature superconductivity conductor that has a higher temperature?
Yes. So I mean, in principle, things can get arbitrarily complicated. I think numerics has already shown that if you add T prime, you do get superconductivity. But that does, of course, not mean that you reproduce this. And I mean, okay, I should have said this, but this phase diagram is, of course, a sketch, right? Like, because exactly as I was like quoting, we don't really know what the phase diagram looks like. So this is based also on what people have seen in experiments on the cuprase. And so if you really want to see all of these phases, like the pseudogap phase, superconductivity, the strange metal phase, and so on, I think it's not clear that you get that if you just include the T prime term. So it might be that you need to include more complicated things. I kind of hope so, to keep me in my job, but yeah. But I mean, yeah. I think my approach is more, and maybe, you know, okay, I don't have a sketch here. But one thing that we understood after we thought about this, like geometric string theory and the single hole a lot, is that one way that, for example, we could get strong binding, so at least strong pairing, is to go to a slightly different type of microscopic model. And this, of course, does not guarantee you that within those models you now get superconductivity, but it at least gives you like a stronger binding energy, so that makes us optimistic, and it gives you mobile pairs. And so my perspective is a bit that you don't necessarily, like, there's two routes you can go, right? One is that you really want to reproduce exactly what has been seen in cuprate experiments, and you want to model that as well as possible. I think that's super interesting. I think it's also super interesting to try to understand what terms in the Hamiltonian you need to reproduce really those measurements. And I think the other route is to say, okay, this is like a model that describes strongly correlated fermions and things that can come out of it. And if you start to understand some of the mechanisms at play, maybe that's already enough to, you know, like spark your imagination to come up with a different model that maybe has some of the properties that you care about. And then you can go back and see whether you can design a material that has that Hamiltonian without that necessarily being the cuprate materials.
So would it also be possible to, like, would you say, like, try to learn the microscopic model from the data, so go the other way around, so use a machine learning approach to parameterize some general Hamiltonian and try to fit phenomenological parameters and produce the experiment?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, and this is something that I'm currently super excited about. So with Henning in a different project, we looked into Hamiltonian reconstruction, or Hamiltonian learning is what you would call what you're describing, so that basically you have some measurements, and say, for example, you have some measurements on the thermal state of a system, and you're trying now to figure out which Hamiltonian would give you those measurements. And we did that basically based on snapshots, so based on snapshots that you would get from actual experimental data from a quantum simulator. And that worked actually pretty nicely. And one thing that I'm wondering about now is whether you can go and do the same thing if you have quantities as you would get them from a solid state experiment. So say, for example, if you have a spectral function measurement or something like that, if you can go and take that and try to reconstruct a Hamiltonian from those measurements. So I think it should work, in particular because you, in a way, have much more information if you have, for example, a spectral function. And of course, like experiments on these materials have been done for like 35 years, so there's a lot of data to go through. But I don't know yet how well it works. And so I should also say the way that like solid state people are doing this at the moment is that they basically like there is some for some limits. For example, if you have a if you are looking at some quantum magnetism and you have a so if you are looking at the dynamical structure factor, so some spin properties, for example, of which you would get from neutron scattering, then they have some expansions where they basically just compare their experimental data to these expansions, and you get the coefficients in your expansion out, and that basically tells you what the Hamiltonian would look like. But that's just the case if you do something like neutron scattering, if you probe spin properties. But if you do something like angular resolved photoemission spectroscopy or optical conductivity measurements or something like that, there is no real like good or like very efficient procedure to do that. So one thing that people really do is they do a numerical simulation, typically exact angularization on like a small system, to reproduce their measurements, and then they change the parameters in their Hamiltonian just like by hand, and like, you know, like make some change in this direction, make some change in that direction to get this ED simulation to fit the experimental measurements best. And so I think I'm quite optimistic that you can do this in a more efficient way if you, because the way that we did it here, when you compare to when we compare to the snapshots, is that you literally do a gradient descent in the space of your Hamiltonian parameters. And I think the exact same thing in principle should be possible if you compare two solid state experiments.
In your work with the convolutional, the interpretable work, I noticed that you compared it to a fully nonlinear network, and it reaches kind of the same accuracy. And I was wondering if you found that surprising.
Yeah, I don't know how generally this would be true. So I think in our case, I can, let's see if it makes sense to go back to this. So in our case, I think one of the reasons this is true is because we are looking at a finite temperature state, and there is basically no real non-local correlations in here. And so therefore, what we're doing really is like just looking at these, like in this case, 3x3 filters, and we kind of in a way can already tell that most of the information will be contained within that. I can imagine that you can cook up models in which this interpretable architecture would be of worse than the standard nonlinear activation function. I guess you always, to some extent, make a, and of course, I mean, this is also, you can always tune the parameters more, right? And like, you know, like change your learning rate more and so on to maybe get a better accuracy in one or the other. So I would say always take comparisons like this with a grain of salt in the end. But I would also say that I would think that you can, I would say to get the full expressivity out of this interpretable network structure, you in principle would need to keep increasing your filter size and keep increasing the order of your correlation functions. And then I think if you go the limit all the way, then I definitely would expect it to be as expressive as a standard nonlinear activation function. But at which filter size and which order of correlation functions that happens, I wouldn't make any strong statements about.